Reports of migrant children and pregnant women being cut by razor wire assembled by state officials. He also reported concerns about the river barriers forcing migrants to cross the Rio Grande in more dangerous parts of the river where they can drown. The Texas Department of Public Safety announced an internal investigation into the medic's allegations, but has denied his accounts of state officials directing troopers to withhold water from migrants and to physically push them back into the Rio Grande. The website of Voice of America, voanews.com, has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Justice Department on Monday, 24th of July, sued Texas Governor Greg Abbott over a newly installed floating barrier on the Rio Grande that is the Republicans' latest tactic to try stopping migrants from crossing into the United States from Mexico. The lawsuit asks a federal judge in Austin, Texas, to force Texas to remove a roughly 1,000-foot or 305-meter line of bright orange wrecking ball-sized buoys that the Biden administration says raises humanitarian and environmental concerns. The lawsuit claims that Texas unlawfully installed the barrier without permission between the border cities of Eagle Pass and Piedras Negras in Mexico. The buoys are the latest escalation of Texas border security operation that also includes razor wire fencing, arresting migrants on trespassing charges, and sending busloads of asylum seekers to Democratic-led cities in other states. Critics have long called into question the effectiveness of the two-year operation known as Operation Lone Star, and a state trooper's account this month of measures injuring migrants has put the mission under intensifying news scrutiny. In anticipation of the lawsuit, Texas Governor Greg Abbott sent President Joe Biden a letter earlier on Monday that defended Texas's right to install the barrier. Governor Greg Abbott accused Biden of putting migrants at risk by not doing more to deter them from making the journey to the United States. "Texas will see you in court, Mr. President," Abbott wrote. The Biden administration has said illegal border crossings have declined significantly since new immigration restrictions took effect in May. In June, the first full month since the new policies took effect, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the CBP, said migrant encounters were down 30% from the month prior and were at the lowest level since Biden's first full month in office. White House's Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre told reporters that Governor Greg Abbott's policies as a whole have made it difficult for U.S. Border Patrol agents to access the Rio Grande. "Those are unlawful actions that are not helpful and is undermining what the president has put forward and is trying to do," Karine Jean-Pierre said. In a letter last week, the Justice Department gave Texas until Monday, 24th of July, to commit to removing the barrier or face a lawsuit. The letter said, "The buoy wall poses a risk to navigation as well as a risk to public safety in the Rio Grande River, and it presents humanitarian concerns." The state deployed the buoys without notifying the International Boundary and Water Commission of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Mexico's Secretary of State asked the federal government to intervene, saying the barrier violates international treaties. The lawsuit is not the first time that the Biden administration has sued Texas over its actions on the border with Mexico. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland in 2021 accused the state of usurping and even interfering with the federal government's responsibility to enforce immigration laws after Governor Greg Abbott empowered state troopers to stop vehicles carrying migrants on the basis that they could increase the spread of COVID-19.
This is Azadi Square, the most famous in Tehran. Tiny black flags hanging around the tower are not there at ordinary times like this. But now, these small black flags are symbols. They are the signs of one of the most important mourning ceremonies in Iran. I am a filmmaker, and you can only hear my voice. I am the narrator of the documentary, and this is Azadi Square. These days, all of us are grieving for the martyrdom of a noble man, Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam. He said once, "If you have no faith, at least be a free man." Our home is near Azadi Square. In Persian, Azadi means freedom. Like many other young people, I write the Imam's name on my car's rear windshield. I'm heading to a city lying 677 kilometers from here. It's one of the most beautiful historical cities in the country, known for holding vigorous ceremonies for the Imam every year. Yazd, a desert city in southeastern Iran with very humble and warm-hearted people who also speak with a charming Persian accent. It is the city of beautiful, tall wind catchers and the most important mud brick city in the world, the city of winds and wind catchers. Wind catchers are in fact towers acting as ventilators. Yazd has a dry climate with very hot summers, and the wind catchers are built to cool the inside of the houses. This is Dolatabad Garden, home to some of the tallest wind catchers in the city. Since the advent of Islam, Yazd has been known as Darul Ibadah, or the place of worship. Yazd means pure and holy. It is named as the holy city, or the land of God. First of all, I have to find a hotel. I have plenty of time until tomorrow, which is a holiday. Meanwhile, I can start seeing the sights. The hotel staff is shrouding the white columns with black cloth. From the hotel, I make my way to Imam Javad University to meet Mohammad Saper, a young, affable professor of economy who is also the university's cultural chief. According to Professor Saper, after the death of Muawiyah, the first caliph of the Umayyad dynasty, his son Yazid became heir to the throne and he became the Muslim's caliph. Since Yazid was a corrupt and oppressive person, Imam Hussein did not accept to swear allegiance to him. The Grand Mosque of Yazd. From the university, I head to the Grand Mosque of Yazd, one of the most beautiful architectural constructions of the Temurian era. The building is one of the architectural masterpieces of the 9th lunar Hijra century. Scaffolds have now been erected around the mosque in order to refurbish the building. The old janitor says the area spans 10,000 square meters. The mosque is famous for its wide dome, tall entrance, lofty minarets, and its unique and beautiful tiles. When I was filming the old gates of the mosque, I heard some people almost whispering in Spanish. I was surprised. There was an Iranian translator and two female Spanish doctors, Ilma, a lung specialist, and Lola, an ENT specialist. When they start to leave, I hear a charming elegy from a handicraft store. The name of the store is Khurshid Khanum, Miss Sun. Saeed, the shop owner, is watching a mourning ceremony held for Imam Hussein on his computer. He fights back his tears for a while, but very soon, he gives up. Khurshid, the son, is Saeed's grandmother's name. He named his store after his grandmother and carved the emblem of the sun on all its handicrafts. He says the old door locks and the lanterns are his favorites. Although I try hard to convince him to have an interview on Imam Hussein, he refuses to accept, saying he is too shy. But when I turn off the camera, he says, "I hate lying. I love Imam Hussein because he never lied under any circumstances, and he only sought to get the truth out. On his hard disk, he has a lot of religious music from Yazd. I give him my flash drive, and he copies some of the songs onto it for me. Then I buy a map of Yazd from him. Saeed shows me the locations of the Tasua and Ashura ceremonies in the city. Look at the postcards from Yazd. They have photos of all the historical and tourist attractions of the province. Saeed tells me Amir Chakhmak Square is close. So I go there on foot to show you Nakhshir. But what is a Nakhl? There is a lot to say about that. In the same neighborhood, there are other handicraft stores that have really beautiful stuff. I like to stay longer to take a look. We never get tired of looking at and buying Iranian handicrafts. How about you? There is a mosque named Amir Chakhmak, one of the most beautiful in the whole country. It was built in the 9th lunar Hijra century. In 1935, it was registered as a national treasure. Next to the mosque, there is a Nakhl, the oldest wooden one in Yazd. It is 9 meters high and 450 years old. Like all other Nakhls, this one looks like a cedar as the symbol of freedom. It weighs around 4.5 tons and takes at least 150 people to lift it up. The Nakhl is here only for public display and has not been lifted for years because of its old age and the likelihood of damage.
My name is Saeed. I'm half German, half Persian.
He's from Germany and now studies Persian at Dehkhoda School in Tehran. He's just arrived from Shiraz and takes tens of photos of Amir Chakhmak.
I live in Hamburg in Germany, and today I'm here in Yazd. We're in the month of Muharram, and in the next 2 days we're going to have the Ashura. The Iranians have like this really, really big and important holiday tomorrow and the day after.
Mr. Azizullah is a former school teacher and principal. He says he's learned from Imam Hussein not to tyrannize anyone. He says because of that, you cannot find a single student or teacher who was mistreated when he was in charge. This is Yazd, the holy shrine of Sayyid Jafar. It is the time of Maghrib and Isha prayers. Tomorrow is Tasua, a day before Imam Hussein is martyred. Mashhad is Iran's second populous city after Tehran. Since it's home to the shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shiite Imam, Mashhad hosts millions of pilgrims every year. Jalal says, "It's been years since I started writing the name of Imam Hussein, but I haven't been honored a pilgrimage to his shrine. I wish I could go to Karbala as soon as possible and see the Imam's shrine from up close." Being a follower of Imam Hussein is a national school of thought. During Muharram, Iranian Armenians, Christians, Zoroastrians, and all other religious minorities also mourn. This is the Zoroastrian fire temple in Yazd. The city's best confectionaries are the Haji Khalifa stores. The sweets and cookies of Yazd are widely popular in Iran and are the main souvenirs from the city. Baklava with flavors of pistachio, almond, and coconut, or qutab cookies are really delicious. I'm a fan of freshly cooked qutabs myself. When you put it in your mouth, it just melts away on your tongue. Baklava and Ghouta were traditionally served at both celebrations and mourning ceremonies in Yazd. During Ashura and Tosa, you can see a lot of people serving nokl, or sugar-coated almonds, among the mourners. The clock in my hotel room strikes 11. I lay on my bed, exhausted. In our official calendar, Tosa and Ashura are public holidays. I begin surfing the net for pictures of the beautiful views in the city. Commenting on Imam Hussein's uprising, a website writes the Imam's movement was not personal. It was a universal human movement. If the goals of a movement are truth and justice, it'll be supported and respected by everyone. It's the morning of Tosua, the ninth day of Muharram. All businesses are closed today. All the stores and tourist attractions are shut down. Today and tomorrow are highly important for all Shias. They think doing business on these 2 days is an insult. On Tosua, everyone grieves as if they've lost a loved one. A mysterious silence reigns supreme in the city. These mud passages are reminiscent of those days. People hoist flags across the alleys. The flags bear the name of Imam Hussein, the other imams, or sentences in their honor. They are mostly green, black, or red. These are the three colors of Muharram. Red is the symbol of blood, the bloodbath in Karbala. Green represents the nobility of the Prophet Muhammad's family. It's the color of the Prophet and Islam. And black, the color of grief, as it is in most other religions. People are preparing for today's mourning ceremony. Young people have written different things on the back windshields of their cars, mostly about the attributes of Imam Hussein and his family. Mohsen is an accounting graduate. He was walking in his own solitude when I asked him to show us one of the biggest places for cooking nadhr, or votive food. It is also a tradition to cook other foods such as khemeh stew, meat and fried potato, or masabzi stew, meat and vegetables, adas polo, rice and lentils, or abgusht, broth. People here believe that helping to cook the nadhr foods brings a lot of heavenly rewards. Mr. Ali Khojasteh collects the money for the nadhr from the people, and based on the amount of the offerings, he cooks the nadhr food. Some of the mourning ceremonies are specific to Yazd, such as the nakhl lifting. But the rest, such as the chest beating ceremony, are conducted all over the country. In Yazd, there are many mourning groups called hayat, each neighborhood having its own hayat. The people gather in the mosque or the mourning place of their neighborhood a month before and rehearse the elegies and poems that they want to perform during Tosua and Ashura. When they are prepared, they immediately stay in line for the main performance so that they can perform their ritual at the time set for them. If someone narrates the tragedy, everybody stops to listen. And when he sings the elegy, they accompany him by beating their chests or beating their shoulders with tiny chains in sync with the rhythm. Each hayat takes its turn, entering through the main gate, and after its performance, it exits from another. The ladies usually sit around the hall or upstairs watching the ceremony. They sit in grief in a sign of mourning for their imam. I ask a religious singer for an interview. He accepts despite his fatigue and a sore throat. His name is Mohsen Soltani. He was born in Yazd. He sings elegies for the family of the Prophet. Imam Khomeini led Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979 and established the Islamic Republic of Iran. O Hussein, you are so oppressed. You are so lonely. The world came to realize the depth of your solitude and perceived the message of Hussein, the son of Zahra, in the Karbala uprising. He said, "Woe unto the wretched." He said, "O people, I staged the uprising to protect prayers to Allah. I rose up because I saw the religion of the Ummah of my grandfather was endangered. I rose up to tell the people that dying with dignity is better than living with humiliation. Our ship is sinking. He is the ark of salvation. O uncle, come to us. We are desperately thirsty. O despairing Euphrates, do not be oppressive, because you will finally get disturbed." This group is now singing an elegy about Hazrat Zainab, Imam Hussein's sister. Many believe the Karbala uprising wouldn't have been complete without Hazrat Zainab. They say if it weren't for her speeches and protests, the Karbala tragedy would have been consigned to oblivion, and Imam Hussein's movement would have soon be forgotten. It's interesting to know that Zainab held the first mourning ceremony for Imam Hussein at the Grand Kufa Mosque. Imam Hussein's uprising was an outcry that broke the ominous silence. He rose up at a time when nobody dared speak their mind. He protested against the ruling regime and broke the silence by embracing martyrdom with absolute awareness. When he refused to swear allegiance to Walid, the ruler of Medina, he signed his own death warrant, launching a campaign that would eventually lead to his martyrdom, an act becoming of men of God. He knew he wouldn't be able to defeat the enemy, yet he decided to give his life. Since time immemorial, heroes have always tried to change the course of history towards human virtues. And Imam Hussein's revolution stands out as a glaring example. "If my life will protect Islam," he said, "then, O swords, hit me." Beating narrow strings of chain on the shoulder blades is another form of mourning in Ashura ceremonies. It signifies a physical form of grieving. The mourning processions beat their shoulders with chains, according to the rhythm of the elegy, as a symbolic gesture. This is Mr. Tahomi, a strict mathematics teacher. I arrange an interview with him and the head of his hay'at, Mr. Abyar, at a beautiful traditional hotel in Yazd. Mr. Abyar says, "Because Ashura is a reformist and anti-oppression cause, it continues to inspire other revolutionary movements. A case in point, Iran's Islamic Revolution of 1979. The morning of Ashura, this is Abul Ghassem Hosseini at 9:45 a.m. Try to picture this place when no one's in it. Everybody is cleaning and preparing. Flags are hoisted, and the huge Nakhl decorated. Hello, Nakhl. Some greet the Nakhl when they see it. They touch it and then rub their faces with the same hand to get a sacred sense. ladies come to find a place to sit because they know it'll be impossible to find one in the afternoon. In another neighborhood in Yazd, a smaller Nahl called the Nahl of the Arab neighborhood is being decorated. They place mirrors on both sides of the Nahl as a symbol of the brightness of Imam Hussein's body. They tie the Nahl with thick robes and adorn it with green cloth. The green cloth has a lot of fans because after the ceremony, everybody likes to have a piece of it as a sacred souvenir. The morning ceremonies start with different programs. This is an alomet, and it is seen in most of the morning ceremonies across Iran. It is somehow an ancient symbol of cedar and the symbol of freedom and eternal life. Alomet moves in front of the procession as a sign of respect to the martyrs of Karbala. With regard to these cars, Dr. Salehi says, I myself have seen such carnivals only in Yazd. The cars move along city streets, evoking memories of what happened on that fateful day. But in general, we have a theatrical play across Iran called Ta'ziyeh. The actors on the cars are also performing the play. Zuljana was the name of Imam Hussein's horse. In the morning ceremonies in Yazd, you see horses called Kotal. They represent Zuljana. The horses are groomed, doused with rose water, and dressed in red or green. Someone takes hold of the horse's harness, leads it in front of the parade, all the while stroking its head. When the ceremony is over, they feed the horse and give it back to the owner. Like Tasua, on Ashura too, each neighborhood offers its own Nathr food among the neighbors. Apart from that food, enough to feed many people, you'll also catch sight of people serving other things outside their homes or on the streets. And they do it hoping their wishes are granted. This one is called Sholazard, a dessert made of rice, sugar, rose water, saffron, butter, pistachios, and almond nuts with a cinnamon dressing. It's really delicious. Sholazard has a lot of fans. And this is the famous Nogl of Yazd that I showed you before at a confectionery. This man has packed together chocolate, Nogl, raisins, roasted peas, and a prayer. This handicraft salesman serves hot milk in front of his store. In front of the mosque, people serve hot tea. This gentleman serves cold water to the people in a jar bearing the name Hazrat Abbas, one of Imam Hussein's brothers. And there they are, our Spanish friends. We ran into them on our way to see the Nahl lifting ceremony. Can you hear the call to prayer? This is the noontime prayer on Ashura, very important to us. It was then when Imam Hussein asked the enemies to give him and his troops time to say their prayer. But the enemy shamelessly rejected the request and kept fighting. Despite that, the Imam and the men and women on his side stood in prayer, marking a watershed moment in the history of Islam. Now is the time for the Nacht lifting. People flock to the places where Nacht lifting ceremonies are conducted. This is Mir Chakhmah Mosque, where the Nacht of the Arabs neighborhood is set to be lifted. This is Wacht Soar, or Time Square, of Yazd. And this is the oldest clock tower in Iran. In 15 minutes, one of the biggest Nachts of the city will be lifted at Abul Qasim Husseiniyeh. You must recall our morning visit to the Husseiniyeh. Do you remember me telling you to imagine this place empty? On their leader's call, the Nacht is lifted off the ground several times. Then the young and strong carry it on their shoulders, revolving around the Husseiniyeh barefoot. A number of people stand at the front and end of the Nacht to steer the bearers. Like a magnificent ship, the Nacht rides the waves of people. The reflection of the sun on the mirrors and swords dazzles the eyes. Tears, wails, grief. After each round, the leader orders the Nacht bearers to stop and catch their breath. After a brief chest beating, elegy, and prayer, the next round starts. From the evening of Ashura, what's known as the Night of Loneliness begins. People lit candles on the streets in memory of Imam Hussein and the loneliness of his orphans. The candles are a sign of respect and sympathy for Zainab, who spent the night of Ashura looking for the orphans. You cannot hear the voices of the crowd on the Night of Loneliness. Normally, people don't beat their chests or sing elegies. They just whisper and grieve in silence. The next morning, all the flags and black banners are removed from the walls of Abul Qasim Husseiniyeh. The women of the neighborhood clean the flags and banners, fold them, and keep them somewhere safe until next year. So is the Nacht. The person in charge of the Nacht and the men in the neighborhood strip it of its embellishments. Business in the city gradually goes back to normal. Everybody, like Mr. Azizullah Aitamnejad, goes back to work. Life is back to normal, but the memory of Imam Hussein is etched in the memories of these people and fills them with anticipation for next year's ceremony.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remember the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
In the Limelight.
Chris Williamson, the chief business economist at Standard & Poor's Global Market Intelligence, has said that Britain's economy has come close to stalling in July, which, combined with gloomy forward-looking indicators, reignites recession worries. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. Economists warn Britain is facing a prolonged economic slump caused by higher interest rates, with the battle against inflation set to weigh on growth for years to come. EY Item Club, the only private sector forecaster to use the same model as the Treasury, has slashed its forecast for economic growth in 2024 and 2025. As it said, interest rates were now on track to be higher for longer. In its latest quarterly update, the group said the economy is set to grow by 0.8% next year, less than half its previous prediction of 1.9%. The economist said gross domestic product growth will rise to 1.7% in 2025, down from their previous forecast of 2.3%. Martin Beck, the chief economic advisor to the EY Item Club, said, "You have got this much bigger rise in interest rates than we were expecting, and that takes time to hit the economy because of fixed-rate mortgages. It will hit harder next year than now." He added, "The Bank of England's hawkishness is going to condemn the economy to sluggish growth, even though inflation is probably going to come down quickly of its own accord." The Bank of England has so far raised interest rates from 0.1% in December 2021 to 5% now, and is expected to go further in the coming months. Despite a drop in inflation in June, Bank of England officials are concerned that continued strong pay growth could keep prices rising. According to data from the job listing website at Zuna, which provides labour market data to Downing Street and the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, advised salaries increased by 3.6% recently. According to website at Zuna, vacancies remained above 1 million in June. Tony Wilson, director at the Institute for Employment Studies, said these figures show that despite the recent small rises in unemployment, the labour market is still incredibly tight. Tony Wilson said the labour market's strength poses risk for future inflation. As well as prompting sluggish economic growth, EY Item Club predicts higher for longer interest rates will cause house prices to stagnate this year before dropping sharply in 2024. Economists predict a 10% decline from the peak. However, forecasters said low unemployment, relatively high savings and lender forbearance should help limit forced sales and provide some support to prices. The rate of price rises should fall to 3 to 3.4% next year and 1.7% in 2025, allowing the Bank of England to begin cutting interest rates late next year. Despite cutting its forecast for gross domestic product growth in the coming year, EY Item Club upgraded its short-term outlook. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. The pound is on the course for its longest stretch of daily falls since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, amid growing speculation in the currency markets that a weakening economy will limit further increases in UK interest rates. With a new report saying that Britain's economy almost stalled in July, sterling lost ground for a seventh day in a row against the US dollar, its worst run since March of 2020. The losing streak reflects the belief that the Bank of England will no longer need to raise official borrowing costs from 5% to more than 6% in order to tame inflation. Threadneedle Street's Monetary Policy Committee meets in the coming days when it is expected to raise interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point in its 14th consecutive increase since December of 2021. Higher interest rates tend to support currencies by offering investors a higher yield, but sentiment has turned against the pound in recent days, and in early London trading, it extended its fall against the US dollar by a quarter of a cent to $1.281. Prior to its 7 days of falls, sterling had stood at $1.314, its highest level in the past 15 months. Fresh support for the notion that the Bank of England will not need to tighten policy as much as previously anticipated came from Purchasing Managers Index, a monthly snapshot of the state of the private sector produced by Standard & Poor's and the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply. The report showed output falling from 52.8 in June to 50.7 in July, a level only slightly above the cut-off mark of 50 that separates a growing economy from one that is contracting. Activity in the service sector slipped from 53.7 to 51.5, while the recessionary conditions facing manufacturing worsened, with output falling from 48.1 to 46.5. Chris Williamson, the chief business economist at Standard & Poor's Global Market Intelligence, said Britain's economy has come close to stalling in July, which, combined with gloomy forward-looking indicators, reignites worries about recession. Chris Williamson added, July's flash Purchasing Managers Index survey data revealed a deepening manufacturing downturn accompanied by a further cooling of the recent resurgence of growth in the service sector. He added, rising interest rates and the higher cost of living appear to be taking an increased toll on households, dampening a post-pandemic rebound in spending on leisure activities. Meanwhile, manufacturers are cutting production in response to a worryingly severe downturn in orders, both from domestic and export markets. Samuel Toombs, a British economist at Pantheon Macro, said the survey strengthens the case for the Monetary Policy Committee to revert to raising bank interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point at next month's meeting, rather than unleash another half a percentage point hike. The increase in interest rates delivered to date appears to be increasingly slowing the economy. The composite index fell to its lowest level since January and to a level consistent with gross domestic product merely holding steady. Meanwhile, experts warned that British households will continue to bear the burden of soaring energy prices, contributing to the ongoing cost of living crisis in Britain. The latest report by Investec Bank PLC projects that the average household energy bill will remain at £1,900 per year throughout the third quarter of 2024. In a note, analyst Martin Young noted that while this figure is slightly lower than the initial estimates, it offers little respite for struggling households. Adding to the gloomy outlook, consultancy firm Cornwall Insight has recently unveiled its own forecast for the energy market. According to their analysis, high power prices are anticipated to linger until the late 2030s, exacerbating the financial burden on consumers and businesses alike. Starting from 1st of July, the energy price cap for dual-fuel households paying by direct debit based on typical consumption is set at an annual level of £2,074. Prior to the energy crisis, the standard annual cost for gas and electricity for a typical British household was £1,271.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Hello, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a show that keeps you updated on events taking place across Africa, from the ever-changing political landscape, the evolving social scene, innovation and technology, to massive natural resources. We bring the continent closer to you. My name is Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. In today's episode, we are focusing on the recent visit to Africa by Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi. He visited Kenya, Uganda, and Zimbabwe, heading a high-ranking delegation of ministers, diplomats, and private sector representatives. This landmark visit has been dubbed a success as it opened new frontiers for cooperation between the Islamic Republic and African countries.
Achievements of Iran's president's visit to Africa. On the 11th of July, Iran's president embarked on a three-nation visit to Africa, for the first trip in 11 years by an Iranian president. The visit aimed at increasing Iran's footprints in a continent that is set to outperform the rest of the world in economic growth over the next 2 years. Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, has arrived in Kenya on the first leg of his three-nation tour of Africa. The president was greeted at the Nairobi airport by Kenya's Foreign Secretary, Alfred Mutua, and later received an official welcome from his Kenyan counterpart, William Ruto, at the State House. A 21-gun salute was performed in honor of the Iranian president and his accompanying delegation. Addressing a joint press conference after holding talks with President Ibrahim Raisi, Kenya's President William Ruto said his country will exploit the strong ties it enjoys with Iran to expand trade.
It is a special privilege to host President Raisi in Nairobi, and his presence is testimony to the strong ties between Kenya and Iran. It is also a demonstration of our shared commitment to cooperate for the benefit of the people of our two countries. I am delighted to report that President Raisi and I have just concluded highly productive bilateral discussions on a broad range of very important issues. During our meeting, I affirmed to His Excellency President Raisi the important place of Iran as a critical strategic partner for Kenya and the value that we place on the friendly and fraternal relations between our two countries. On our historical engagement and areas of cooperation and development that include education, scholarship, infrastructure, health, water, fisheries, agriculture and housing, urban and metropolitan development, among other areas, I expressed our gratitude and commitment to expand and deepen these relations. President Raisi and I had the opportunity to engage views and share ideas about emerging opportunities to improve the balance of trade between our two countries. Kenya and Iran are strategically situated to be each other's key points of entry into our respective regions.
Speaking at the joint presser with his Kenyan counterpart, Iran's president said that the Islamic Republic warmly shakes the hands of all African governments for cooperation. He noted that Iran is ready to share its experiences, especially technology, with Kenya.
We have a wealth of experience in the field of economy and science and technology. Today, in the field of petrochemical products, in agriculture, and also in science and technology, we have a wealth of experience which could be great candidates and nominations for cooperation. One is the health. While health and medical equipment could be a fertile ground for cooperation in terms of pharmaceutical and medical equipment, we could have cooperation with each other in the field of agriculture and fisheries. We could establish very productive cooperation in other business fields as the president has correctly pointed out, now noted in his speeches, we could have cooperation in other business fields.
To get some insight into President Rais's visit to Kenya, we contacted Jafar Barmaki, Iran's ambassador to Kenya. Now, Mr. Ambassador, can you tell us the significance of President Ibrahim Rais's visit to Africa, particularly at this juncture when the world is shifting from a unipolar international system to a multipolar approach of global affairs?
As you know very well, visits by heads of states to different regions often serves various purposes, including political, economic, and diplomatic objectives. When a president visits Africa, it can indicate a desire to strengthen bilateral relations, explore trade opportunities, engage in cultural exchanges, or seek support on specific international issues. Regarding the shift from a unipolar international system to a multipolar approach, this generally refers to a change in the distribution of power and influence among multiple countries on the global stage. In such a context, visits by leaders can be seen as an attempt to build alliance, establish partnerships, to navigate this evolving global landscape. To fully understand the significance of President Raisi's visit to Africa and its implication within the challenging global order, it is important to consider the specific objectives, agreements, and outcomes of the visit, as well as the broader geopolitical dynamics and regional interests at play.
A significant achievement of President Raisi's visit to Kenya was the launch of two Iranian-made agricultural and mapping drones at Iran's House of Innovation and Technology in the Kenyan capital of Nairobi. President Raisi visited this tech hub where he unveiled Pelican multipurpose agricultural drone and Dorna mapping drone, both manufactured by Iranian knowledge-based companies.
Kenyan President William Ruto has also hailed this Iranian tech center, saying it is a highway to bring Kenyan youth to knowledge and technology. Let's take a listen.
Kenya is also highly encouraged by the great interest shown by Iran in promoting technological and entrepreneurial innovation among Kenyan youth by promoting incubation of Kenya's startups and creative industry through the Iran House Innovation and Technology Center. This is an outstanding intervention that is innovative and directly aligned with our national aspiration towards creating a digital superhighway and a robust digital economy as primary pillars of the bottom-up economic transformation agenda. As a global innovation powerhouse, Iran has made significant progress in the development and deployment of modern technologies in key industries such as agriculture, manufacturing, and telecommunication. I have therefore invited wider and deeper collaboration in these and other critical sectors in the interest of our shared socio-economic development objectives.
Ambassador Barmaki, can you elaborate here on the importance of Iran's House of Innovation and Technology to Kenya and indeed the rest of Africa?
President Raisi's visit to House of Innovation and Technology, let's say Iran House of Innovation and Technology, in abbreviation we call it IHIT, and unveiling of agricultural drones indicate a potential opportunity for technology transfer and knowledge exchange between Iran and Kenya. Collaboration between these two countries can facilitate the transfer of expertise, promote innovation, and foster capacity building in the agricultural section, as we do now, but we intend to expand it. These can contribute to the development of local knowledge-based industries and growth of African drone technology sector. The adoption of such kind of technologies can create also economic opportunities such as job creation and growth of associated industries.
Now, Kenya, a leading East African economy, is also set to benefit from Iran's automobile technology. Kenyan president announced that the Islamic Republic of Iran will launch an automobile assembly factory in the Kenyan strategic port of Mombasa, a move that is expected to create employment and boost the industrial capacity of this East African nation.
His Excellency President Raisi conveyed to me information that will be good news for stakeholders in our mechanical and automotive sector, including dealers, engineers, technicians, and other workers. Iran's intention to set up a motor vehicle assembly plant in Mombasa to manufacture an indigenous Iranian vehicle that has now been given the Kiswahili name Kifaru, meaning rhino. And I hope it will be a tough one, Your Excellency. I am confident that the project is unstoppable, as this name suggests.
The manufacture of Iranian automobiles in Kenya is an entry point for the wider East African community bloc, composed of seven countries. Now, this economic bloc has a population of nearly 283 million people. Now, Ambassador Barmaki, Kenya is famously known as the gateway to East Africa. Can you elaborate on the significance of the visit of the president to this country?
President Raisi's visit to Kenya could carry several significant implications, especially considering Kenya's reputation as the gateway to East Africa. If I want to refer to some of them, I can say that visits by heads of state often aim to enhance diplomatic ties and cooperation between countries. President Raisi's visit to Kenya could signify a desire to deepen and strengthen the relationship between Iran and Kenya. It may involve discussions on various topics such as trade, investment, security, and cultural exchanges. As we know very well, Kenya is one of the largest economies in East Africa and serves as a regional economic hub. Its strategic location, well-developed infrastructure, and business-friendly environment make it an attractive destination for investment and trade. President Raisi's visit may involve exploring economic opportunities and establishing partnership in sectors such as energy, infrastructure, agriculture, or technology.
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Ambassador. We now take a short break before we continue with our program focusing on President Ibrahim Raisi's visit to Kenya. Stay with us.
Iran and Kenya are also working closely in the health sector. Iranian Red Crescent Society has several clinics in different African countries. In Kenya's capital, Nairobi, Iran operates two medical clinics providing services to the needy in this country. Iran's support for Kenya's health sector has been described by President Ruto as critical in attainment of universal health in this country.
His Excellency the President and I noted that Iran is already an important partner in Kenya's health services sector and maintains two health centers in Nairobi. To actualize the universal health objective of our administration, which is a critical pillar of our agenda, we continue to invite and learn from the expertise of countries like Iran, which has achieved a great degree of advancement in medicine and modern medical technology.
One of the highlights of President